Welcome again to Season 5 of Food Conversations. Before we begin, of course, we again acknowledge that we are living and working in the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmek people, and that fairly resolving this situation continues to be an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now, today my guest is someone who has embraced two cultures and two very different worlds and bridged the gap between those settings in a very material way by developing a unique, high-quality product that comes from one part of the world but ends up in another with significant meaning in both places. Now, you're probably all wondering who I'm talking about. Well, I'm going to introduce you now to Carla Furster, founder of Frog Friendly Coffee and also its productive dreamer. Carla has joined us in the studio today to tell us about the decades-long journey she has undertaken to create a successful business while learning a great deal about how the world really is. Carla, welcome to Food Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me, Warren.
We're delighted to have you here because your story is a compelling and unique one about travel, not just in geographical terms, but also travel in terms of awareness and thought and consciousness and getting to know a lot of different things about the world. Now, let's start with a little vocabulary. I use the phrase productive dreamer. So give our listeners a short definition of what a productive dreamer really is.
Well, I believe that we all have to really live with intention. And for me, a productive dreamer is living my values out loud through my business productively, making choices that reflect my values and embracing the power of aspirational profit.
Okay, well, let's move on to a couple of terms you used in our conversation before coming on air. You called yourself a centrifuge. Now, I'm a physician. I know what a centrifuge is, but you're not talking about that. What's a centrifuge in human terms?
I guess for myself, a centrifuge is that catalyst of energy, hopefully inspiring and propelling others to live their dreams and live consciously and with intention. And so the centrifuge for me is, you know, I'm very non-traditional in my business, and we are so impacted by our supporters and our customers. And I really feel that I'm that centrifuge that's always spinning and always evolving to meet the moment.
A centrifuge in Latin means you move away from the center. And in this case, I would see center as being convention and you moving away from. Is that part of it as well?
Oh, absolutely. I don't stay in the lines. And the food business for me is an area of great passion, and how I respond to my concerns and my humor in food is reflected in how I choose to do business.
I think there are a lot of listeners who have wanted to color outside the lines, and now they're going to hear from somebody who makes it a professional activity.
Yeah, and I'm an encourager around it. I think we all should engage in sort of stepping outside that box.
So another phrase you use was a possibility thinker.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get the 25 words or less definition of possibility thinker.
Well, I guess the possibility thinker for me is, you know, challenging norms that we're conditioned to in our sort of everyday worlds. And we become sort of conditioned of just doing our 9-to-5 and just, you know, sort of going through the paces. And for me, being a possibility thinker is, you know, for myself, I've got a very close relationship with my inner voice, and there's always dialogue going on. And I love that challenging norms, finding other avenues, other ideas, other possibilities.
Well, I think our listeners will come to understand that Carla has embraced contrast in many areas of her life. And we'll also learn how to produce a fine cup of coffee. Now, the two cultures and geographies that you've been engaged in a deep way are Canada and Mexico, especially Oaxaca, southern Mexico, Olmec country, you might say,
yeah,
if you look at archaeological records.
Yep.
Yes, indeed. But also material security on the one hand and material vulnerability on the other, people who have to scramble and live somewhat hard-scrabble lives. And as well, a tranquil community, as you know, people will hear, growing up in Crescent Beach and West Bank near Kelowna, you had that sort of easy life in some respects, but also a life that didn't expose you to some of the harsh realities of life, which mm-hmm. in Mexico are often easy to be seen. So you're born and raised in West Bank and then Crescent Beach. So two, the interior and then the coast. Your father was a well-placed executive. He was in CEO in Royal LePage. And your mother was a nursing
leader,
practitioner
yeah.
and a leader. She wasn't just a nurse who worked on the ward. And then you had one leg in BC and one leg in Mexico because your family would go down to Mexico in the winter and spend time holidaying. And then you found your paradise, as you mm-hmm. called it, Puerto Escondido. That's my fake Mexican-Spanish accent.
You did great.
What was unique about that little town?
Well, you know, Oaxaca is a very special area of Mexico. It's, you know, very rich in culture. It has 128 dialects and that many sort of unique cultural groups. It's a food capital of Mexico. But for me, it's, you know, when we landed there when I was a young teenager, it was almost like my soul found its home. It resonated.
And you met a family there that became a second family.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell about that family.
It started with the oldest brother, Gilberto, who is a hustler, you know, with tours. And, you know, you do whatever you can when you've got large families to provide for them, especially in the third world. And we met him. He was the manager of the property that we were staying at for our first trip there. And he just embraced us. And for my dad, it was sort of the beginning of a very close friendship.
How did your dad react to a guy who's out trying to get ahead? And
you know, my dad would, you know, he did. He embraced it. He loves that energy and that passion and that gusto. You know, we had spent so much time in Mexico at that point. My dad was very supportive and schooled and embracing the culture and the energy. And him and Gilberto just met on a very close personal level and just opened up their family to us. And, you know, 13 kids and all the extended and, you know, that has, you know, we're 30 plus years on in this really wonderful, rich, extended family relationship.
The town itself is, at the time in 1970, there were 400 people living in it. I checked it out. And it was also used, interestingly, as a point for distributing coffee from the interior. It was actually a coffee
Yeah, the
port.
Oldest coffee port on the Pacific coast of Mexico, Central America at the time.
Seems like a little serendipity moving in to alter the terrain a bit. The feeling of connection, how would you say it was new and strong for you? What made it so strong?
Well, I guess
you said your dad was away a lot working and you know, that kind of mm-hmm. thing. Mom obviously must have been working too.
Well, just in terms of the relationship in Mexico and what made it strong, you know, it was just sort of an embracing. Oaxaca, for our family, it was stepping back into a real Mexican culture. And you can still feel that today when you visit. It's very popular with Canadians. But you are, you know, I always say to people, if you've been to Puerto Vallarta or Manzanillo and then you go to Oaxaca, it's like you're stepping back 50 years. And also the richness of how they care for their community is absolutely profound to me. We can always say that, you know, what drives my passion is sort of endeavoring to do something meaningful and leave a legacy there. But we also have so much that we can learn from them, you know, in sort of that family fabric where the old care for the young and nobody goes hungry, no one goes without, no matter how little is available. And it's, you know, that moral fabric to me it's inspiring. It lends to how I parent and how I care for my family.
There's a famous book about the economy of Peru written by an economist who studied the so-called black market, which is what we call it, but they have lots of different names, the alternative market. And he said it's bigger than the main market, mm-hmm. the main economy. And it's because people do exactly what you said. They care about one another and they make mm-hmm. sure that everybody's looked after and taken care of. But you also saw some of the tough things that you wouldn't have seen. You described one instance where you were outside a bank, and what happened then? That was
yeah, horrible. You know, it was in the Anacade on the main strip in Puerto Escondido, and I was a teenager, and there was a very drunk surfer passed out in front of the bank liquor store, between the doors, and the police just came along and beat him to death. And it was such a shocking moment for me, coming from this, you know, very safe and cloistered, and even traveling in Mexico, sort of sheltered in the experiences that we had, yeah, of sort of that breakthrough of the realities of life.
It's something that, when we talked before the show, it was clear that you'd melded these two worlds in a fairly comprehensive way. It wasn't just tourist stuff. It was actually becoming embedded in some respects in that culture yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing experience. Your father had, even though he was a CEO of a large corporate entity, he also had certain values that he lived. 20% of his income.
Yeah, a great example. I mean, he was always very aware of his responsibility. And, you know, I think coming from a farming Saskatchewan immigrant background that moved west when he was a young child, you know, I also have to, you know, speak to like the Salvation Army. And I think that was what left a real mark for him as a child, is the support that they received in Port Alberni when they moved west. Left a profound mark on him around our responsibility to each other. And when you have extra, there's, again, that aspirational profit of helping.
The little story you told me about skating and drink money.
Yes.
Carla, tell everybody about this, because it's a wonderful story.
Yeah, well, I think the writing was on the wall for my parents when I was very young, and I used to figure skates. And my dad, you know, we're talking in the 70s, and his you know, weekly allowance at the time was $20. And he trustingly gave me that $20 to get a drink and a snack, which would probably at that time have cost a couple bucks. But, you know, my concern was that everybody had a treat, and I spent his entire $20 ensuring that everybody in my skating club had a drink and a snack. And I have no qualms with that. I would do it all over again. I live my life that way.
So your father was initially taken aback, but eventually, obviously,
yeah,
said,
we still,
well, that's what I do.
Well, and we still occasionally talk about that memory, because for him, it was that moment of, like, you know, that anger and his weekly budget, but also the selflessness and care for others.
I remind listeners again that I'm talking with Carla Furster, who is the founder and inspiration behind Frog Friendly Coffee. So what sort of things did you do with your second family, your Mexican 13 children family?
Well, you know, it was a lot of just exploring the mountains. They came from a small native village called Xila, which is about 10 minutes north of Puerto Escondido. And a lot of their family roots were up in the mountains. So a lot of our time together was spent exploring in the mountains, just sort of experiencing a real experience away from the tourist fray with a real Mexican family.
Did you see any coffee plants when you were out wandering around?
No, actually, it wasn't even on my periphery.
So this was pre-coffee?
Very much pre-coffee.
And what did you see in this family as their adaptation to being in this very different social milieu, having to hustle, as you said?
I guess for me, it was their pride in the hustle, you know, in their commitment to community and their absolute faith that no matter what, there was going to be food on the table.
So they would do whatever they had to do to make it get there. You also, at this point in time, were coming to realize that you were, as you described it, not traditionally teachable.
No.
All right. Listeners, listen up. How do you be not traditionally teachable?
Well, I guess just beating to the sound of your own drum. You know, I'm an explorer, and when somebody shares a fact with me or how a process, you know, I'm a questioner, so I immediately, you know, roll it over in my mind and if there's a better way or...
So in your family circle, when you were doing this questioning, how did that go down with your mom and dad?
You know, I'm sure there was challenging moments. I was a challenging teenager. but, you know, I think at the end they always knew and supported my sort of my humanity, my care, my empathy. It was something that was embraced, you know, sometimes frustratingly, but they ultimately, you know, were very supportive of my moral center and my sort of itch to endeavor to make more.
And they obviously manifested that in their own lives. I mean, whether it's the old story, don't do as I do, do as I say. And yet what they did was really quite commendable. I mean, something that you can look back and say, I value the kind of principles that they had in their
lives. Absolutely. And, you know, I don't, you know, I don't think they ever defined, you know, or saw that I was going to endeavor to be a business owner. They probably didn't feel that was in my wheelhouse. I know my mom's dream was that I would end up in healthcare. But I'm not friendly in healthcare with other people's body fluids. But, you know, at the end of the day, they are my greatest cheerleaders. I truly wouldn't be here without their support. My dad's mentorship is invaluable, you know, his background in business and also his investment. He, you know, other than being our greatest cheerleader, has been there to help bridge my greatest learning moments and mistakes.
Which it's always good to hear when people say, we have mistakes in our history, because it actually connects to pretty much everybody listening to this show. Everybody knows that things go awry and you just have to do a workaround. It's exactly true. So there was a point where I think your mother might have had a hand in it. You spoke to the chaplain at the Surrey Memorial Hospital. You told me this was kind of a pivotal experience for you. It made some changes in your consciousness.
Yeah, well, my first, you know, great loss of my life was losing my Aunt Darlene. And it made me question everything. I was raised in a loosely Lutheran family that was very sort of open in their sort of beliefs. And losing Darlene for me opened up this sort of, you know, who are we? You know, just around beliefs and spiritualism. And my mom was this catalyst who introduced me to this absolutely profound chaplain at Surrey Memorial Hospital, who led a sort of theology volunteer chaplain program that I joined. And it was absolutely life-changing for me.
What did it bring into your consciousness that has changed you ever since?
You know, it really drove home for me our human vulnerability, and also just, you know, learning how to truly listen. There's nothing more profound than sitting with someone who's facing their last days on this earth and processing through their regrets and their anxieties and that life journey, and then reflecting and really sort of embracing the vulnerability and living with that.
The most profound experiences in our lives are often ones of loss.
Yeah.
And adapting to loss. As a physician, I often see people who have avoided thinking about loss for so long that when they start to face their own mortality, they're really doing a lot of catch up.
Yeah.
And it's often a very difficult experience. Another, much later in life, about a decade or two, a little bit more than a decade ago, you read the book that Margaret Atwood wrote that was actually the transliteration of her Massey lectures in 2008. The book is called Payback, and the subtitle is Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. You said that cemented for you what you were endeavoring to leave behind. What was there?
Well, you know, it's such an incredible book. I started reading that book expecting it to be about that traditional perception we have about debt. But really what it is about is the debt we leave behind. You know, and at the time when I read that book, I was sort of haunted by all of my to-go Starbucks cups. Because the truth is the story of the Christmas Carol is actually about the debt we leave behind.
Indeed.
And you imagine those chains and what's on the end of your chains. And for me, it was Starbucks coffee cups, which is terrible. I've improved. But, you know, it really left me pondering, you know, what do we leave behind? What is our debt to society? And how do we sort of neutralize that in leaving a positive effect? And I compel everybody to read that book because it is so thought-provoking and it really marked my character.
Well, I read the Wikipedia description, which is very detailed, by the way.
Yeah.
They go through the five lectures and discuss the content at some length. And it's clear, I mean, Margaret Atwood is a very intelligent person, and she has a lot of insights. And all the reviewers said she combined humor and an incredible array of sort of anecdotes that animated the whole process.
Yeah.
Was that part of it, too, having a story, like stories in it?
Oh, absolutely. Having it referenced to sort of experiences and stories and hit true, you know, human history that sort of drove home. And we always grip to debt in this perception of profit, but debt is so much greater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the debt of, you know, how you leave your relationships, yes. How you do business, you know, is it in a way that is you're endeavoring to leave a benefit, or is it, are you creating a debt?
Indeed. And I think the seeing what you're describing is seeing that your life doesn't end when you die. You're leaving something behind that has an influence on other people.
Yeah, beyond a carbon footprint.
Yes, indeed. That's a very simplistic way of looking at our indebtedness. So during this time, you were doing various things. You had different kinds of jobs, and they weren't jobs where you had to do a lot of mathematics. Carla, by the way, told me that mathematics was a torture. But obviously you would have to use some because you're working in retail, you were doing landscaping, a variety of different jobs. Actually, you headed off towards being a Red Seal plumber at one point.
Yes, incomplete, but yes.
What were all those? I mean, these are various kinds of engagement in the mm-hmm. world. What did you gain from those kinds of experiences?
Well, I think on one hand, I was, you know, searching for that answer for myself, that mission. And I was just rolling around from, you know, these opportunities. Obviously, gardening and landscaping for me was, you know, my greatest passion.
It's like being in a playpen.
Oh, it is. And just interacting with life, right, with your hands in the soil. Mm. But, you know, all of those relationships and all of the feedback from those relationships is what ultimately put me where I am.
The process also was counterpointed by going to Mexico and spending time with Pedro and his family and hiking around in the wilds.
Yes.
And that started to lead to some developments. You didn't see coffee plants out in the wild when you were hiking, but somehow coffee, a branch of coffee berries, because mm-hmm. that's what they're like before they're roasted, came into your life. Do you want to tell listeners how that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, every time we came home from Oaxaca, or my parents came home from Oaxaca, they would bring coffee home in garbage bags from the mountains. And, you know, it just never connected for me. And, you know, Pedro and I were always talking about...
You just thought your parents were kind of strange.
Well, no, and I wasn't really, you know, coffee was in its early days of, you know, evolution into the specialty sort of look that we're at right now. And, you know, I never, you know, I drank Nabob, I drank that coffee. There was no sort of awareness. But then, you know, Pedro and I always had these conversations of this desire to endeavor to do something in the mountains that could...
He was imparting some of his kind of entrepreneurial drive.
Yeah, well, and his experience with us in Canada really sort of...
Yes, you know, he used to come back with your family.
Yeah, it really broke the mirror for him of sort of different realities, the paradoxes. And, you know, you have these dreams and you have all these fanciful ideas and you move on and you grow up. And I was a mom and I was working at this wonderful nursery, and Pedro called me up and he's like, I've got it. This gentleman, Simitrio, brought me this branch with coffee cherries on it. We're going to harvest it. We're going to do it all, and we're going to ship it to you, and you're going to sell it at the Christmas craft fair at the nursery.
Pedro being directive to somebody who's not directable, but clearly you had...
Yeah, well, we had a shared, you know, shared values, yeah. And we did. We brought up a skid of coffee. You know, knew nothing. Nobody knew what we were doing. Everything was sort of just the best we could do. You know,
even
right down
pants.
To the people in the mountains. You know, it had been milled wrong. It had been roasted in the mountains in the hollowed out stone circle camels over open fire. Mm. And shipped by air, which is incredibly expensive. But we sold it all. It, you know, although it didn't look great, it tasted great. And that
you
was
sold it all at the
Christmas
nursery.
Yes. We did these crazy staged Christmas craft fairs and with wine and cheese and coffee. And, you know, just on the passion of what we were trying to begin, we sold it all.
And in the middle of this, a fellow named Frank turns up and is And as now the chief roaster for Frog Friendly Coffee, how did he arrive in your life?
Well, you know, I don't know that there would be Frog without Frank. You know, we were sort of finding our way as friends and dating, and he was one of the renters in a house up the street from our family's home. And I sold him on what we were going to try and endeavor to do. And I sold him so well that he gave me his life savings. And
which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it
was. He obviously demonstrated a genuine trust in what you were.
Yeah, yeah. And started this ball rolling that's, you know, been, you know, extremely affirming, but also, you know, extremely fraught with great lessons, great growing.
I remind listeners again that I'm talking with Carla Furster, who is the founder and inspiration behind Frog Friendly Coffee. So it started small, but it started to, in an evolutionary way, kind of
grow.
Move ahead. Mm-hmm. So one stage in the evolution of Frog Friendly Coffee was Pedro. He got a machine.
Yes.
What kind of machine did he get? I'm as ignorant, I'm sure, as most of our listeners about the actual process of preparing coffee. But he bought a machine that sort of decorticated the berries.
Demulched.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, that was one of the first sort of early purchases that was supported by, you know, his extended family in La Chau in the mountains. And it was a small demulcher that sat beside the river, and two live wires touched, and you poured the coffee cherries into the hopper at the top, and it would separate the mulch, and then all the mulch would be used as compost.
So what part is of the berry or the cherry is the mulch? What is that?
Well, the mulch is all of the fruit of the coffee cherry. And so the coffee beans are the two seeds that are inside the coffee cherry. And then the coffee mulch is the fruit. And it's actually part of the cherry family. It's actually really quite delicious and tart. It has an incredibly high yeast content.
So if you eat a coffee cherry, does it, it's tart, is it sweet or is it just tart?
It's got
tart?
Like a sweet tart.
A little.
It's sharp.
Do people eat coffee cherries?
Not typically, because the coffee beans are huge, and so it's quite awkward to sort of put a whole coffee cherry in your mouth. You know, the ratio of coffee bean to fruit is in the bean's favor.
Well, that's probably cherry's loss and coffee's gain. So this machine by the river with the live wires started to enable you to process initially separate out the fruit from the seed, which is the bean.
Yeah. And we had, you know, tremendous support in the mountains. We had the most remarkable man really guide Pedro in his learning, a gentleman named Simitrio. And he was the keeper of the forest for the people of his village in Nopala, which is just about a 25-minute four-wheel drive from La Chau in the mountains. It's actually one of the oldest continually inhabited villages in the world. It's absolutely profound. But he was this amazing expert in coffee and in vanilla. This is ground zero for true wild vanilla. And so he was this right hand for Pedro and myself. I mean, the quality of coffee that he provided for us is unparalleled. He's greatly missed. We lost him about 10 years ago.
Which is always part of an evolutionary process. What did he think of you and Pedro going into the coffee business?
You know, I think he was bemused. When he started working with us, he was in his 70s, which is a very advanced age in the mountains of Oaxaca. And so I think he was, you know, sort of following us along, bemused, curious to see where it was going to end up. And also, you know, it provided, you know, an income source for his family working with us.
That's always a feature, is it not, in communities like the ones you were connected to in Mexico. In our part of the world, we sort of don't see the people who are marginalized, but in a small village, everybody knows who's got what. Mm-hmm. And that spirit you were talking about earlier of everybody looking after everybody else is, in a sense, almost derivative of that intimacy, the fact that everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah, I would almost say, like, in the mountains of Oaxaca, that, you know, communities like Nopala and La Chau, you know, they're greater than towns. Although, you know, you have many family units in those towns, they actually operate as a larger collective family unit of sort of responsibility for all, in service to the greater community. I really believe that those of us in the comfort of the first world in North America could really learn and be inspired.
Having traveled a little bit in the Americas, South and Central, I could only endorse that 100%. The attraction of seeing people who really are inclined to get along with each other first. Mm-hmm. And yes, things go awry once in a while, but the overriding goal is to have amiable, friendly, mm-hmm. supportive.
Well, it's also their culture. They, you know, like it was funny when I used to read about the history of the slave trade in Mexico, which is, you know, this unfortunate history that we have through colonialism. And, you know, they abandoned using slaves in southern Mexico because of the philosophy of Mexicans, right? Which is mañana. They have enough for today. So who worries about tomorrow? And so what, you know, you imagine these Spaniards trying to yield these people to work, but if they're fed for today, they're fine. And it's such a beautiful thing because, you know, in our society, we are more, but the simplicity and the beauty of living for today because we have enough for today.
It sounds like you really absorbed a cultural value that is pretty profound and something that a lot of people feel is missing in mm-hmm. industrialized nations where there's a lot of material abundance, but there's a lot of emotional and spiritual deficit, mm-hmm. the debt that we were talking about earlier. So machinery, plans to set up supply, delivery routes, et cetera, this was what became part of the last basic 20 plus years of your life. What's the sort of basic trajectory that took?
Oh, I would definitely say sort of three steps forward, two steps back. You know, it's taken so much grit. I mean, I've made huge mistakes and learning moments that should have finished us.
Okay, Carla, give us just one example of what you consider a huge mistake, just because other people might say, oh, that's not bad.
You know, I guess, you know, putting so much faith, I guess, you know, going back probably 15 years when I brought in my first full container and going on the faith of the word of my bank that they were going to help finance it and having the container arrive and not having the funds to pay for it. And
wow.
Being sort of in a situation of responsibility to source, to the relationships and figuring it out. And figuring it out, I did. And
what was the solution? Because that's like the last chapter in the novel. We'd like to know how it turned out.
Well, you know, I was very, very blessed that, you know, I was able to, you know, greet my family with transparency and have a family that was able to step behind me and help me bridge and carry on the show.
So they helped to pay for this thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very humbling moment. Nobody ever wants to have to sit in their caca. But, you know, I'm sure, you know, I operate on faith, but there is a level of business responsibility and having things in writing, right, that we all need to accord by.
Well, I think banks in this part of the world have not earned a reputation for openness and generosity.
Yeah.
So I don't think, I think if we're going to ascribe this to anybody, I think we can ascribe to the bank and
yep.
the individual banking system. Proponents. Along the way, though, in as part of this evolutionary process, there were a couple of people who played an important role. One was the head of Canterbury Coffee.
Yes, Ken Wathman.
And you met him in somewhat interesting circumstances.
Yeah, I was actually invited with my very humble, at the time, Royal Blue coffee bags with terribly amateur stickers. I was invited by a friend that was in the pub industry to a pub and restaurant show in Vancouver. And to display my very humble bags with his pub equipment and see if I garnered any sort of response or opportunity. And within about 10 minutes of being there, Ken Wathman appeared. I didn't know who he was at the time. And we started talking coffee.
Always the best. It's spontaneous then.
Yeah. And he, you know, he told me that what gripped him to me was that I was transparent, that I was learning. And I didn't know everything. And the sort of energy behind what, you know, my ambition. And we became very close, and he graciously and very serendipitously invited me into Canterbury. And they, for 2 years, gave me an amazing, warm, supportive environment to grow and learn and open up their customers for, you know, receiving Frog on their orders. Absolutely, you know, a real marker in our road for sure. And, you know, for me, he's a consummate gentleman. For me, he will always be at that sort of epitome of class.
I want to ask you a little bit, just sort of stepping aside from talking about Frog Friendly. As a woman, a young woman, And we often have young women on the show who are farmers, who are committed to value systems, who, like you, are not afraid to say it isn't always easy and are quite comfortable saying that that didn't work, we got to do something else. I wonder if there's a different kind of consciousness that you and other women bring to, say, the business world or the farming world, the producing of food world, in that it's okay for women to say, I didn't get it right, I'm going to do it differently. For men, it's sometimes a moment of defensiveness and resistance to acknowledging vulnerability. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, unfortunately, our society grooms us to, especially men, around ego and being invincible and always right and unfallible. But, you know, one of the challenges of that is that, you know, without being humble and transparent and experiencing mistakes, we don't evolve. We don't grow. We, you know, one of my greatest characteristics that I am allergic to is people that finger point. Because, you know, and I come from food service, so it's very personal to me. And it, you know, because for me, if, you know, finger pointing is a deflection that unfortunately impairs your growth.
Absolutely. Because it means you're not going to own what's happened that you are directly responsible for. Well, that's worth the whole price of admission today. Thank you, Carla. You also met the head of Neptune Foods.
Yeah, the director of sales. You know, Canterbury at the time that we roasted with them were still, you know, craft roasting, which, you know, for me is under 100-pound batches. And they made the business decision that was best for them and embraced a larger format of roasting. Yeah. And graciously, that wonderful gentleman, Ken Waithman, introduced me to Julia Stabar, who at the time was the director of sales for Neptune, which later became GFS. And introduced me to my new learning, which was all things food service and, you know, understanding a different distribution channel than I'd been exposed to.
And you also went out with salesmen.
So great. Learning how to sell. You know, great learning around communication, that's for sure.
What would you say it was something really important that you learned about selling? Not selling things that don't deserve to be sold, but selling things that have quality and getting into somebody's mental space to kind of bring them on board.
Well, I think it's really connecting with their humanity. You know, we're always, especially in the food service, it's always about cost per ounce, cost per serving, and appealing to how we can better their offerings. You know, unfortunately, in food service, coffee is always that last part of the meal. Although it's, you know, a budgetary item on a menu, it's a very high margin item. And so we discount it and we typically offer cheap coffee. But when you can speak to someone's passion for their business and appeal to their desire to do better, to market, to share, to dream weave, to compel that moral compass out of them, I think I batted about 90% on the road with GFS back in that time.
Well, I think it's a widely accepted axiom that when you're selling something, the first thing you sell is yourself.
Yes.
And if you come forward with a demonstration of character, of something more than just product, that often works pretty well.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things you said about Canterbury moving in one direction, you moving in another, was that they were going to larger scale roasting and larger scale sales and et cetera. And you said something when we were talking before. You said, I don't want to be the biggest. I want to offer a great product.
Yes.
Is that something that's really been a mantra for you?
Absolutely. There is nothing more important to me than whole quality. And I, as an individual, I do not compromise well. I am that, I'm unbendable when it comes to my values and how I perceive quality. And, you know, fortunately, Frank's the same way. And so, yeah, we have a very clear sort of sense of what whole quality means to us, which means, you know, ethical supply chains, transparency, a true craft roast. So we roast in 44-pound batches. You know, we don't inventory. We roast to order. We really focus on the independent grocers because that's where the opportunity, I think, for a growing conscientious consumer lies.
I think another way of looking at what you're just saying is that another thing you said was profit is insignificant. Of course, not totally. No. There's a codicil. Yeah. So you haven't just said, I don't need to make any money. What you said was profit is insignificant. It's values that count.
Yes, absolutely. Aspirational profit, I really hold that, and I think that's an answer to the future, and especially our imperiled food systems.
To give us a definition of aspirational profit.
Well, for me, aspirational profit is simplicity in a job well done, with those sort of moral measures for myself is, did I do my best? Was I honest? Did I offer the best product possible? And does it reflect my values?
I think that's a pretty good way to live in all respects, not just sell coffee. I remind listeners again that I'm talking with Carla Furster, who is the founder and inspiration behind Frog Friendly Coffee. So we've talked, I think, about the values-based ground on which Frog Friendly Coffee is built. Let's talk a little bit about Frog Friendly Coffee, because we're there now. I think we've arrived. The phrase that's on the website is bringing a sustainable cup of coffee to your home. Now, that sounds like a very simple phrase, but obviously there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scene for that to happen. And that starts in the highlands of the land around Oahu, in Oahu. Why don't you talk about how that, the process, it starts with the donkeys coming, harvesting the cherries and bringing them down.
Absolutely. Well, coffee is grown one of two ways internationally. It is a belt around the equator. So it's either sun grown, which is, very intense, very assisted with fertilizers, pesticides, and other means.
The opposite of shade grown.
We have to be careful with shade grown too, because that's sort of been greenwashed. But, our coffee is a forest coffee. It comes out of the last intact cloud forest of Oaxaca. It's in the Occidental. It was introduced by the Spanish.
Which is the west side?
Yes.
For those who don't speak Latin.
And it was introduced by the Spanish in the 1700s. Oaxaca is a huge sort of ground zero for chocolate production back in the 16th and 1700s. And is, the last stands of wild chocolate in the world.
Chocolate was used as a spice.
Very ceremonial, very important. Yep. Yes. All the moles. So our coffee has naturalized under the shade of the cloud forest. So it really is something that I say that you can't see the coffee for the trees, because it is such a integral part of that ecosystem now.
And you call it wild coffee.
Absolutely.
Is that an attempt to get around the greenwashing of shade grown?
Yes and no. It's also, I guess, the most direct adjective for what our coffee is. It is in a true forest system. And I also, I guess, differentiating, because one of my areas of frustration in our food business is our embracing of certifications that guarantee a minimum standard. And then as a society, our acceptance of minimum standards, because, for certifiers or corporations that sort of define their minimum standards, in their pursuit of profit, are they going to reach for the stars? No, they're going to meet the minimum. And I get very frustrated with that. And, and I'm just going to raise one thing is the Rainforest Alliance certification is an example of greenwashing to me. Mm-hmm. Because, you hear Rainforest Alliance certification, and as a consumer, you would think that it's growing in a forest, birds and this beauty. But really, Rainforest Alliance, you can use up to 60% artificial shade cover. They don't mandate what kind of trees, if you're going to use trees for shade, that you use. So you could be using bananas, which die back every year and don't provide any bird habitat. And you also don't have to be organic. And organic is incredibly important to me, because it's the first line of sort of sustainable practices and supporting farmers in the third world. And we are organic certified through our entire supply chain right to our roastery.
You're in such a strong position to make sure this is happening, because you have, long before the coffee phase of your life, you were embedded in the culture from which the coffee comes. Mm-hmm. And the culture is rooted in the land. It's very much an
Absolutely.
Indigenous
subsistence.
Exactly. And something that is, broadly speaking, starting to be a main focus of many people's thoughts.
Well, and it needs to be. We all, you know, and that people like, you know, when we're frustrated about the state of environment or the state of our grocery world or the foods that are being offered or ingredients, you know, consumers are the superheroes in this. You know, if we harness our individual power of choice and read labels and really ask questions and ask manufacturers questions, nothing excites me more than when a customer emails me challenging me, asking for data, asking for why. You know, it excites me. I very quickly respond because it's like, yes, you know, a consumer that gets it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And also is engaged.
Yeah.
You don't write a letter or you send an email unless you really have an emotional response and you want to express it.
Well, and coffee is a crazy, crazy cluttered gray world, you know, especially since COVID. You know, we've watched a lot of commercial coffees end up on the grocery store shelves, you know, bagged as if they're specialty, but they're not. And, you know, consumers in all areas of grocery need to become advocates for what's in their pantry.
Yes, it's been said often. I think it cannot be said too often that you can institute social change out of your wallet.
Absolutely. I mean, we all think, well, I'm just one person. But the power of when we all sort of embrace our individual superpowers around choice.
So the coffee is growing in the wild, surrounded by a fully fledged
ecosystem.
Indeed. And then it gets harvested.
Yep.
And then it gets put on donkeys in burlap bags or...
Yep.
Have I got the sequence right?
How you does do. Go then? Yeah, no, absolutely. The communities harvest the coffee into what they call sitavos. And a sitavo is basically a small wooden box that holds 1 kilo of cherries. And, you know, one individual can probably harvest a sack a day of cherry. And then those sitavos are filled and dumped into a cistern of water. And that is the first moment of grading coffee. The premium coffee sinks. And the more commercial or off or just not as great coffee floats. And it's sort of water pressure that will now spit that out onto a large drying field of clay or concrete. They actually have to be very careful that there's no organic material because the coffee will actually absorb its environment that it's sitting on. And they'll literally have it laying out until it hits a certain humidity point. The cherries where they've lost just enough moisture to start the milling. And we wet process, so it's run of river. And it goes through, as we talked about earlier, the mulcher. And we actually keep our coffee in husk until we're getting ready to ship it to Canada. And so, and that's when it goes through that final milling. And then we also light sort. So
why do you keep the
It maintains the freshness, especially in an environment like Oaxaca, where you're almost on the equator and you're dealing with extreme temperature and extreme humidity.
Mm. Have you noticed, by the way, on that note, any changes because of the changing climate?
We haven't. I mean, we will. You can see the movement happening right now in South Central America where weather patterns are changing. But very fortunately, Oaxaca, we're in a place where I don't feel that we're going to experience any significant weather changes for another 10 years. But it's definitely concerning.
Fingers crossed.
Yes.
So it's coming down the hill. It's still in the cherry form, but it's going to be processed. It gets processed. And then what's the next step?
The next step is successfully getting it to seaport. So what that entails is hiring private security to get it because, you know, in Oaxaca or anywhere in the third world, second world, coffee is gold.
Mm.
And so it's always brought to port with security. You know, bandidos, there's lots of challenges on the highways of Mexico. And then, you know, with the grace of God, it finds its way onto the scheduled ship. And that I say because we've, you know, had situations, I self-broker, where the container gets stuck for 2 or 3 ships where we're just waiting and, you know, you've got to grease a palm to keep things rolling.
It's a real challenge.
Yeah.
I think that is something that is always more likely in a community where poverty is not too far away.
Absolutely.
I had a couple of colleagues who were anesthetized and robbed in Peru. And the wife in this couple said, you know, I was really outraged at first, but then I thought, here I come waltzing into this place, not necessarily sensitive to the values of the local community, looking like I'm loaded with dough. And, you know, whether they were or not, they certainly had more than most of the people in the community.
Yeah.
And so it was a natural thing to say, well, as an evolutionary process, we don't have much security often in our lives, but we can, and they weren't hurt. Mm-hmm. They just woke up from a brief anesthetic. I think so. The kind that we used to use in Western medicine until recently. So the coffee's on the ship. It's coming to Canada.
Yeah, it's at sea for about 2 weeks. All sea freight food products actually on the Pacific coast have to stop in LA at the LAX seaport for drug inspection. And that, you know, is a very expensive process. It's supposed to be random, but, you know, over the last 18 years, every container we get searched. And that's fine.
Yes.
Get a clean bill of health. You know, and then from there, it comes up to the Port of Vancouver. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that all importers, we all store in the same facility in Vancouver.
Which is what facility?
It's called Seaforth, and it's our insured waymaster for coffee. And so, you know, if you want to protect, be insured, and have your coffee in a climate-controlled environment, that's where we all store and all pull from.
And they're good people to work with?
Yeah, you know, it's a challenging job. You know, it's always, right now Frank's grumbling because it's taking 3 or 4 days to get shipments up here from the warehouse. But imagine trying to maintain a labor force of individuals that are picking up 155-pound sacks all day.
Sure, there's economies of scale clearly at work here. So it comes up. It makes it out of the warehouse. It comes up
to Canoe.
To Canoe and soon to Enderby. And then Frank steps in.
Yes, and we roast in 44-pound batches to order, and so we don't sort of activate any roasting until we have POs in hand or online orders.
And when you have those orders in hand, where does your coffee go?
Well, we do a lot online through our website. We've got great followers and supporters. We also distribute into food service through Gordon Food Service nationally. So restaurants, pubs, cafes, and then also we distribute nationally into grocery.
What's it been like to see this nascent business enterprise go from a branch of coffee cherries to a skid to a container to a shipment to sending it out abroad into the world?
I guess economies of scale and the level of anxiety, you know, it's happened over such a slow roll because, you know, there's been those recovery moments when I've made mistakes and redirection. I mean, we had the Hive restaurant, you know, and coming out of that experience. So I guess, you know, it feels really good. I feel that mine and Frank's learning is meeting the moment, and we have the right mentors and teammates in place and great support from our distributors and customers.
What about your kids? There's four sets of eyes watching their parents engage in this effort and probably saying, oh, that looked like it wasn't so good. Oh, that looks brilliant. Oh, this is, you know, up the ups and downs.
Yeah, well, they're certainly aware of the sacrifice that they've lived through it. You know, through the years, it hasn't been like we're out every evening, you know, dining in restaurants, and there's been sort of considerations and going without. But, you know, I think they're better for it. I think it's going to help them in their character development and just understanding real life.
And
right?
What's their attitude towards your coffee?
Well, they don't drink coffee.
And none of them?
No, well, our 24-year-old does. But, you know, he's in that coffee geek phase where he's just bouncing around with different brands. But
he'll come home.
Yeah, I think they're proud. I think they love our independent spirit. And there's a great value to family time around the Wayfill machine packaging coffee.
You've obviously juggled a lot of balls in the air, the travel, the developing of business from scratch, as they say, and having a home and four children. What would you say if you had a sort of final phrase that summed up, and you can never do this, okay, but I'm just laying it out there, to sort of sum up what you think this has all meant to you, developing this project, you might call it?
For me, it has absolutely affirmed living your values out loud. That is the greatest profit.
I couldn't think of any better way to end our show today, Carla, than on a statement like that. There are so many people engaged now in producing food these days who themselves say those kinds of things. And I think it really is a reinfusion of values into activities that have been viewed in a rather neutral, kind of watered-down way. Now we're hearing about what underlies all those activities, and I think it's a wonderful thing to hear that. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me, Warren. Frog on.
Frog on.